Coming up on this week's show, what could be the biggest retro game of 2025 revealed.
Xbox 360 games are coming to the PC.
And we chat with GOG about game preservation.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our amazing friends at Bitmap Books. Now, have you seen the new book everyone is talking about at the moment? Spotted this in The Guardian actually this week. The Games of a Lifetime, the book that brings to life a look at video game history as seen through the eyes of the legend that is Julian Jazz Rignall, the celebrated game journalist and, of course, editor of iconic games mags back in the day like Zap, CBG and Mean Machines. You can find out more and order your copy right now at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 470, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And great to have you joining us for our first show of March. Spring is in the air, slightly lighter nights here in the UK. This is the time of year when normally Ravi makes us feel really lame. He's out in his garden growing things.
Well, I've started getting in there, but there's a lot to do. Yeah,
the time of year when it's still cold enough to I think warrant sheltering inside though and playing some old school games. And this podcast, if you're a regular listener, you know that we celebrate all things about the wonderful world of retro gaming and technology, bringing you up to speed on what's been happening from over the last 7 days and bringing you guests onto the podcast for a chat each week. Now, one thing that often comes up when we're talking about classic video games is preservation, which is really important. I mean, you know, us guys are big fans of games like Sonic the Hedgehog, but equally, we see the importance of games like Bubsy 3D and preserving them for future generations. I think it is important, all of these efforts that we have, to make sure that these games are not only playable on modern hardware, but also are kind of collected in some way that makes it easily accessible to everyone.
Yeah, and one of these services is good old game. And, GOG have done some absolutely amazing games. We've been covering them recently because they've taken this preservation project and they've really run with it. It's a really interesting thing. And it's good to have them on the show because what they're doing is they're kind of putting love into these games and doing a lot of extras, like getting extra fan content in there and getting them running as well. Like they focus a lot on kind of PC games. That's what I previously had when I've downloaded titles from there, but they do them really well. And, this week we've got the senior business dev of GOG as well, Marcin, coming on. And we've got Adam as well, who's a tech engineer, which is really interesting because Adam is telling us all about how he kind of reversed engineered stuff, got stuff running. And you think about the amount of different configurations out there, different machines, and also different kind of things that were done with these old ones. Like we go deep into a chat about Windows and about, you know, how the operating system's changed and the compatibility and just getting DirectX working, the right version of DirectX, and how hard that can be. And Joe joined me for this interview as well. And Joe, what did you think of it and that the kind of aims of their project?
I found it really, really interesting. And, you know, I don't want to put anybody off with like any sort of like tech talk there because of, I actually found we kind of, it was like a tale of, you know, two sides of the, with the questions, because obviously we went really deep into like the tech side of the preservation scheme, but then we also discussed a lot about like the licensing behind it, which I found really interesting as well. And we, you know, we took a bit of a deep dive into a couple of game series that I might be obsessed with as well.
And how they kind of Resident Evil in there.
how they obtain the licenses and how they go about kind of like communicating with these massive companies like Capcom, etc. And how they make the decisions on what games they're going to preserve and stuff. And like some of it's like really like, wow, I never thought of that. And then some of it's like really, really easy and really, really simple. Like, and it makes sense. Like, yeah, we licensed that. We did that game because we've already got it running. So it makes sense. Like, so we just went and asked about the license. And
it's crazy as well, because they've got such a big library and what they want to do is, you know, really get it well presented and kind of get these titles in the best kind of condition and then put them out. And eventually they kind of want to roll it out. But we talked about how they decide on which titles they want to put in there and which order they want to do it in as well.
I'm sure, like, you know, we're assuming knowledge here, but, you know, we didn't really explain what GOG is. I assume most people that listen to our podcast will know, but they're a digital distribution platform. They've been around for many years, haven't they? And the good thing about it is, I remember buying some old school PC games on their service years ago, and then actually packaged them with little emulators that would make them seamlessly run on a modern version of Windows. So you're probably the same as me, Ravi, you know, trying to get old PC games to run on, like, you know, Windows 7 and Vista and stuff like that back in the day, and trying compatibility modes or DOSBox and that kind of thing. Quite a bit of faffing around, isn't it, trying to do it yourself?
Yeah, and we talk about that as well, how they have their own fork of the emulators, but also how they do a lot of configuration as well. So all that config that you did where you had to go typing through files and, you know, having different commands in there and stuff, they do that all for you, which is really interesting to hear about.
And this massive new effort that we did cover on the podcast end of last year that you mentioned then, Ravi, the preservation program that they've got running right now. So the aim is, I think it's 108 games at the moment. They want to ensure that these games remain updated and playable on modern systems. And the important thing about this is, like you said, Joe, it's even after the developers stopped supporting these games originally. So they take over the maintenance of them. Make sure that you can still play them on, like, you know, Windows 12 when that comes out, and keep some DRM free. And also importantly, gives the players dedicated tech support as well going forward.
Yeah, they fix a few bugs as well.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, a really, really important effort, and love what they're doing to keep these old titles alive. And going to be interesting to hear some stories about not only the background of GOG, which is the official way of saying it, because everyone calls it GOG.
We started calling it GOG in the interview, and then they called it GOG. So we're like, okay, call it GOG. Yeah, we're not sure.
Yeah, it's like id Software, ID Software kind of thing, isn't it? Everyone called it ID for years when you read it, but it's actually id Software. So the guys from GOG are going to be joining us talking about preserving classic titles and keeping them available to future generations of modern gamers. They're coming up on the show in around half an hour from now. But of course, first half of the podcast, that's when we have a little bit of a chat about what's been happening in retro from over the last week. And this story has been absolutely everywhere. And as soon as this dropped, oh my God, I don't think I've ever seen you excited, this excited for a game trailer in years, Joe, when you ping this in our Facebook group.
You always make out I'm like, like,
don't lie, you were. I was as well.
That's what Ravi gets like when he posts his food.
Yeah, or his gardening pictures.
Yeah, this is a Terminator 2D No Fate. I'm sure a lot of people have probably seen or heard of this week. It is absolutely everywhere, and you know, I think the way they've marketed it this week by dropping the trailer, but then they've also done a behind-the-scenes making-of video, which I think Dan said has already got like 200,000 views in the space of like...
in like three days or something, yeah.
Yeah, which is really cool. So like I say, Terminator 2D No Fate is the Terminator 2 game we should have had back in our youth, is what they're saying, back in the day. So this is being made by Bitmap Bureau, who did Xenocrisis, Final Vendetta, loads of other games. Really, really, really fantastic games. And those people who aren't familiar with those games, essentially modern retro games with like 2D pixel graphics, hence the name, you know, the pun Terminator 2D, because it's based on Terminator 2 Judgment Day, the film. So it is going to be a side-along platform, action platformer, where it looks as though you play through the entirety of the, as I was gonna say, the original film, the sequel, Terminator 2, whereas you play as either Terminator, the T-101 model, T-800, Arnold Schwarzenegger, or Sarah Connor. And like the gameplay of it just looks absolutely fantastic. But I think the real kind of showstopper here is those 2D pixel graphics look absolutely phenomenal. They've captured like the essence of Terminator, but with that like 90s vibe so well. Like graphically, it looks absolutely amazing. I'm really, really excited for this. It's coming out in September. So we've already got a release date. We don't have to wait too long for it.
September 5th.
Yep. September 5th. Yeah, it's going to be on, by the looks of things, you know, all modern systems. Xbox, PlayStation, Switch, Steam, etc. No talk of it coming out on any other like crazy consoles. Whereas Xenocrisis and Final Vendetta and stuff, they came out on like everything.
Didn't Final Vendetta come out in the Neo Geo or something, or did I?
Yes, they actually posted an update about a week ago about that. But yeah, that is coming out on the Neo Geo. However, I think the gameplay and the graphics of this might be too much for some of the older systems. I think, you know, this, it looks so polished. It looks so good. My biggest concern about it is that it is only going to be a couple of hours long, because if this looks like the kind of game I wouldn't want to end, because if, for those who don't know, Terminator 2 is like one of my favorite films of all time, if not my favorite film of all time, along with Terminator and Aliens. So I am so excited for this, and the team behind it as well. There's so many amazing people working on this game, which Dan actually pointed out earlier today, how many like kind of friends of the show and people we've had on in the past are working on it.
So Henk Nyborg, he's been on the podcast with Bitmap Bureau on episode 110. And then we've also got the programmer here as well, Quang, and he's been on the podcast on episode 127. So
we saw Quang last Friday at an event. He didn't mention this. He kept very tight-lipped,
wasn't he? This does look awesome, and it looks like it's coming from an awesome team. You know, they've got a great history for delivery, and yeah, just looking at this, it's presenting Terminator in a totally different way, and it really works. Like, I just want to see Kindergarten Cop.
I would love that.
I also saw that Lee Mintram as well, who we've had on Featurecast. I think we spoke to Lee quite a few times. Yeah, he worked with Utah Saints, you know, on the Final Vendetta soundtrack. He's done the music for this as well. So a great team behind it. I think, you know, we're going to have to reach out to the guys and maybe do something to celebrate the launch of this game when it comes out in September. Because as soon as I saw the trailer, which I put in the show notes, and also that making of documentary as well, it's got a bit at the start, hasn't it, where you see the T-1000 doing his famous finger wag, and then you've got the exoskeleton Terminator with the flames behind it. Just looking at that, I thought that could have been like in the arcade in 1992. That would look so at home, like an arcade cabinet. And it's great to see. I mean, I do agree with that line they've got in there, the game we should have had back in our youth, because I had, I don't know if you ever played it, Ravi. Did you play Terminator 2 on the Amiga?
Yes.
Probably not the best remembered game.
Well, also looking at this game, it looks quite like Metal Slug.
It's got a bit of Contra kind of in there as well. There's also some other elements. You've got like motorcycle sections in the game too. So there is a bit of a kind of varied types of gameplay in there. It's not all like, you know, side along kind of shooter.
I mean with the kind of chunky graphics as well, and the graphics are just absolutely beautiful. It kind of what you've come to expect, that high end quality.
I'm really, really hyped for this, and unfortunately, like you said, Joe, we're gonna wait till September, which feels like an agonizing 6 month wait on a play that's right now.
I was like, oh, it's not that long away.
I'll come around fast, I'm sure. But yeah, I think just if you ever dreamed about having, you know, a decent Terminator 2 game at home, you know, on your Super Nintendo or your Mega Drive, this is a game that, you know, finally looks like it would achieve your childhood dreams. Available for modern consoles, coming out a bit later this year. Definitely one we'll be keeping an eye on over the next few months, and keep you up to date with the progress on that. Now, this is a headline that, again, has been another really big story, not only in retro tech circles, but also on a lot of mainstream news sites over the last week or so, that Microsoft is closing down Skype after over two decades. Now, my first thought when I saw this article was, hang on, Skype's still going, is it?
I'd totally forgotten about Skype, and that's probably why they are closing it down. It was a great service. Like, I remember at one point, everybody would be like, Skype me, and they had it's my first big opening to, like, video chat online, a direct kind of VoIP communication, but also had like stuff like the answering service within there. I thought it was really good. It got changed around for a lot of companies, and I think eBay owned it at one point as well, and it got
I'd forgotten about that.
It got quite bloated, and they totally missed the boat with the pandemic. That is the ideal time that they could have refired Skype, but then Zoom became the kind of platform and took over. But also stuff like FaceTime. I always thought Skype was really interesting. I think Skype was probably the first experience I ever had where I could share a desktop and you could, you know, share what you were doing on the screen, which is
presentation mode. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is really interesting as well. But I don't know what your memories are. We've actually found guests and chatted to guests through Skype when we first started this podcast. So it was still relevant when we first started.
Well, the first probably 4 years of this podcast, pretty much all the guests were on Skype.
Yeah.
Apart from the ones that came in the studio. Like you said, until the pandemic came along, which weirdly, I was looking at that, there's been headlines around that as well, but that was exactly 5 years ago that we went into lockdown, which, you know, the fact that that was half a decade ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of blows my mind. But you're right. I mean, yeah.
We use Skype.
We use Skype for everything, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, we were in the studio. So it was, yeah, I mean, it was definitely a huge product. And I think you're completely right with what you said there, because Skype was so prevalent. It was a verb, really, wasn't it? I'll Skype you.
Yeah.
You know, until Zoom came along. And yeah, Microsoft really dropped the ball on that. You know, Zoom shouldn't have come along, this little upstart, and took over it. Bearing in mind that Microsoft bought Skype in 2011 for $8.5 billion. Wow. And they were in a bidding war at the time with Google and Facebook.
You know, so, one thing I remember about Skype as well was having a phone number. So having it, it was the first kind of service where you were connected to a real phone number as well.
Yeah.
And people could actually ring up and you could call a number from your computer, you know, on a commercial service and kind of talk to them. And that was really amazing to me. But I do remember there was a change in it. I think it was Skype for Business and stuff. And I ended up having two apps installed and it was just a bit chaotic. You know, it really reminds me of RealPlayer. Everybody had RealPlayer. It was the standard of things. And then it got bloated and it kind of got filled with stuff. And it would be like, install this. I think you had to install Bing on one of the installers for Skype. And they'd like added a lot of stuff in there as well. And there was, I remember a really annoying Skype toolbar as well that would install on
I hate toolbars.
Your browsers.
Always hated toolbars. And they were interesting. I was looking into a bit of the history of Skype. And I'm probably going to say their name's completely wrong, but it was two guys who made it from Estonia called Priit Kaselau and Jan Tallinn. Not only did they make Skype, they also made Kazaa as well, the file sharing client back in the day. And apparently a lot of the technology in Skype originally was the same as Kazaa because it was like a peer-to-peer client. That's how it did video calls. So that's quite interesting with the looking into the history of Skype.
I think I had Skype Mobile at one point, which was actually being able to do Skype over your handset as well. That was a thing.
But obviously, I mean, it's not that retro, but it's going back over a decade. But I remember when the Xbox One came out with the original firmware, I would often play like Call of Duty on that with my brother. And you could actually have Skype. Remember when the Xbox One had like tiles you could snap around the screen before the update? So you could have Skype in a little window in the corner and do a video call using Kinect.
Yeah, I remember that. And it wasn't amazingly revolutionary, like, but it was that kind of direct IM instant messenger link with it. So, you know, obviously there was like TeamSpeak and Ventrilo and all the other ones that you use for like gaming, and they'd have lobbies and stuff like that, but it didn't feel as kind of professional and direct to Skype. Yeah. And I kind of want to use it again now.
Well, we had the Kinect on the Xbox One that came as part of the pack. So yeah, it meant that you could do a video call while you're playing a game and have like a private chat, which we still do that now, but I've got to set my iPad up now with that AirPod in one ear. So yeah, it's kind of, you know, it's gone backwards a step. And so I mean, they killed that off pretty quickly
missing that pandemic thing. That would have been the hugest kind of, you know, revival. And it would have been very easy to do. And that's totally shooting yourself in the foot, isn't it?
They dropped the ball.
It was all there. Like, you know, everyone had their contacts. They just needed to fire it up again. Yeah.
You could have had it all, Microsoft. There you go. Skype in the graveyard of technology. RIP Skype. Trying to move everyone over to Microsoft Teams. Don't know about you, the idea of running Microsoft Teams on my Xbox, not all that exciting, if I'm honest. Yeah. Hopefully that'll stay away. Right, the next story, I'll link that up if you want to read more. But this one, this is a long-lost PC game. And when I read this headline, I was a bit like, oh my God. I was thinking, who's going to be in this? Is it going to be like some cheesy reality stars? Are you going to be able to play like Jake Goody or Craig Phillips or Brian Dowling.
Wrong Big Brother there, Dan. Yeah.
Fortunately, this is not Big Brother, the NAF TV reality show. This is the George Orwell book. This is a PC game that apparently was set to be released back in 1998. I actually got demoed at E3 back then, based on George Orwell's 1984. But this has now been archived online.
You don't need to play it. You just need to walk outside.
<You'll see. laughs> I like that. Yeah, so this is interesting. So it's one of those games like where like nothing came of it from what I can see. So there was some sneak peeks and, you know, a little bit of, you know, secrecy around the game in 1998. And then it was demoed at E3 in 1998. And then what happened was the game missed its release window. So the game was late to be, you know, to be sent out to release. And then the game just disappeared. And nobody really knows why. And we still don't really know why. And it was being developed by like a really small development company called Media X. And previously, the games they had made were all like interactive autobiographies for the PC. So like On the Road with B.B. King. So
which is interesting because B.B. King had a history of using computing. I don't know if you look, there's a video about B.B. King talking about the Amiga and its kind of influence on his music and history. Yeah, so I guess there's a bit of like multimedia and computer background with B.B. King. Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe there's a link there. So I guess they weren't, you know, destined for greatness with this game, unfortunately, but like Dan says, it's its own story. So it was meant to be a sequel to 1984, and you were going to play as a new character called Eric Blair, which is a reference to George Orwell's real name, which I didn't know until I read this article. And it was going to be that he'd gone back home, and when he gets home, he discovers that, you know, his fiance has gone missing and Big Brother has taken over. And then it was going to be a first person, I'm not too sure, first person point and click game, because it says that it was...
Yeah, it's not a shooter, is it? I'm watching the trailer now, there's not really...
Yeah.
It controls a bit like an FPS, but without the guns.
Yeah, it looks like it controls like an FPS, but it was going to be more of a kind of like I say, point and click mystery kind of game where you would have
like
to
solve... Myst kind of thing.
Yes, there we go. I couldn't think of a game. That's perfect, yeah. I think it was going to be more like Myst. But interesting you should mention that, because obviously in Myst, you go to like panels, don't you? Like still images. Whereas in this, it's fully 3D rendered. I don't know if it's just the video I've been watching, but the frame rate does not look good on this demo. No. it's running at about 5 frames per second, unfortunately. But the reason we're talking about this is because it was presumed a completely lost game with, you know, the game never being released and we're never seeing any more footage of it or anything like that. But then this week on archive.org, somebody has uploaded the demo from E3 by the looks of things. Ooh. And I think it's got a build date of January 4th, 1999 on there. So actually it probably isn't from E3 one then, even though the article I've just read, it says it's the E3 one, but the build date on it's later than E3. So it's probably a newer version of it, but
probably the last one, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely no information on where they got this from, if they worked on the game, you know, or if they just randomly, a family member worked on the game or anything like that. It's just there for everybody to go and have a look, go and have a play, see what it would have been like. It doesn't look like any of the puzzles or anything is interactive or kind of like intact in the game. It literally just looks like a bit of a barren industrial kind of area you can walk around.
Like, it looks very low developed, but then looking at the B.B. King one that they did, it's actually pretty mad. It's like a point and click one, and he's digitized Mortal Kombat style walking through streets. And then
you can, that's like, brilliant.
Yeah, you can click on stuff and enter rooms and stuff. So maybe, you know, it's a bit more developed, and the graphics might be pre-rendered, and then they have stuff over the top. And I think it's pretty ambitious doing a follow-on story to 1984 as well. Yeah, interesting concept overall. I think it could have been like one of those oddities. It's really good. And the demo is running incredibly slow. I guess they haven't optimized it or ran it in any graphics card.
No, it's still just an alpha version, yeah.
Yeah, and software rendering, probably.
Although apparently in the archive file that you can grab now from archive.org, there are some further levels and logic from the what would have been the full game within the files. So you can delve down, you know, stuff that exists outside this demo as well. So you can kind of have a bit of a look at, you know, what else they were planning for it as well. There are obviously a lot of bugs in it with a bit of an alpha as well. They're saying, you know, don't put it in full screen until the cutscene or it'll crash and it needs, like, you know, Windows 98 to run properly.
It's a lot of cleaning up, yeah.
Yeah, so it is always cool to see that. I mean, you know, we've talked about this before. I think it is always really sad when you see these demos and you're excited about something that it never made it onto market.
Well, yeah, it was showcased at E3 in 1998. So maybe some people saw, you know, kind of like this alpha version running and maybe have some more details about it that might pop out in the future.
Yeah, and I wonder if you're right as well, if maybe it was someone who was part of the team because it's kind of been uploaded anonymously, which would make sense because, you know, never know who owns all these copyrights and stuff. So I'm going to get hold of that. I'll link it in this week's show notes. Now, this is another massive story. And this one kind of blows my mind a little bit because I remember us guys getting really excited just a few months ago that they were bringing N64 games to the PC by recompiling them, which is a process of basically taking the original games, decompiling them, and then making them run on other platforms like an x86 PC, for example, often with upgraded graphics and higher screen resolutions as well. And we saw a bunch of N64 games get that treatment at the end of last year. Now, this seems to come on leaps and bounds. They're already doing Xbox 360 games, the first one being a PC port of Sonic Unleashed.
Yeah, I think this is good. I think, you know, N64 games would probably be harder because, you know, Xbox is still an Xbox. It's still kind of a PC in a form, you know.
And it had Power PC though, didn't it? The processor in it.
Yeah, but there's been Xbox 360 emulators around for quite a while as well, and Xenia is one. And they've done a lot where they, you know, optimize the graphics cards for it. They have like lots of shading and all of these kind of extra features that you can do. But yeah, I think you're right. It was PowerPC from what I remember, the 360.
Yeah, so it was a PS3 as well. Most of that generation was.
But wasn't it that core or Cell
power? Cell PC? was the one in the PS3. But this is it's a new set of tools, which was inspired by the work of Mr. Wise Guy, who did the N64 recompile project. This one is called Xenon Recomp and Xenos Recomp. So the idea is that they convert Xbox 360 games and code and shaders into C++ and HLSL, which then means it can be recompiled for other platforms, including modern PCs. So the good thing about this is, as well, it also gives you stuff like out-of-the-box support for ultra-wide monitors, high frame rates at working with really nicely with modern graphics cards, much higher resolution as well, and I think most excitingly for you, Ravi, lots of opportunities for modding these old games.
Yeah, I think that's always the advantage with the PC. You know, you can do all these extra things. And I think that's really nice that you can add it on and also use the power of the kind of processors and stuff you've got. I've never played Sonic Unleashed, which is what they've got actually recompiled. I don't know what it's like. It could be amazing.
Have you played it, Joe? I've got it.
You know what? I have not actually played any of the kind of like the bad 3D Sonic games from like the mid-2000s onwards.
I didn't think it was that bad. I thought this was all right, apart from I wasn't a fan of like the werewolf stages in it.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're a werehog, don't you?
Yeah, they weren't the best stages.
But yeah, I've heard this is a better version of the game, the recompiled version.
Yeah, it's not as bad as Sonic 06.
Yeah,
I wouldn't say.
Recompiled next. Get it working properly.
Apparently, there is an effort ongoing to do that, apparently.
I'm not Project surprised. 06, so.
You know what, though? It's weird because I did have two copies of Sonic 06 that went missing. And I was trying to find them a while ago after AVGN did his video on it. I thought, I'll play that again, see how bad it really was. So I remember my mum buying it for my brother and I for Christmas one year, or the year it came out of six. And my brother hated it and gave me his copy of it as well. Lost them both. Thought I'd go into eBay to try and find a copy of it. It was about 50 quid people wanted for it.
Really?
Yeah. This is just after the AVGN video. Whether it's gone down or recently, I'm not sure. But yeah, a few years back, I was like, God. I remember them selling that for like 50p in CX.
Yeah. And now you see it in charity shops. I never picked it up. My days.
I'm looking at eBay now. Yeah, buy it now, £31.37.
I'm having a quick look as well.
Definitely gone up.
Yeah, it's definitely gone up.
Next time you see Joe at a retro gaming show on his stand. Yeah, trying to get the bargain off him. Shouldn't have mentioned that. But yeah, I think it's cool. I mean, you know, there are a bunch of games that are, you know, from the Xbox 360 and the PS3 as well. I mean, it would be nice if this kind of recompiled efforts kind of went on to PS3 games as well.
Yeah, a bunch of those would be nice. I think this might be a nice solution, actually. But I'm in the process of trying to modify Xbox 360, and it's this reset glitch hack thing, which, but it looks really tough to actually install on the model that I've got. And it, I think it's easier on the 360 Slim. So, you know, going down this route of just putting it on a PC probably might actually work out for me.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there are a bunch of games on there. I mean, you know, I remember buying Outrun on the arcade as well, which would be nice to have an upgraded version. I remember Ridge Racer 6. Love that on the 360. Would be awesome to play that again. Project Gotham Racing 3 and 4. That
Joe's,
on there too.
Joe's favourite game, Full Spectrum Warrior.
Oh, God.
See, I just think it's mad that we've kind of, you know, jumped on a couple of generations in this recompiled effort in just a couple of months. So very cool to see. Xbox 360 games getting a bit of love, so if you want to download that, that is available on GitHub right now. If you want to play that version of Sonic Unleashed, you do need the original game to take the files up, obviously, for copyright reasons. But if you have got a copy of that in your collection, you want to see it nicely polished up, running in ultra-wide resolutions on your modern PC, that is available now. Now, I did mention Ridge Racer there, and this next story kind of got my hopes up a little bit, because you guys know that that is definitely one of my favourite racing franchises, even going back to the original PlayStation and playing Ridge Racer. We had the arcade kind of car set up in my local arcade at one stage. We sat in the red car and had like the screens in front of you. It was absolutely awesome. Cost about £3 to have a go on that, I think.
Get a can of pop and gel your hair up and be like, right, I'm going to play Ridge Racer.
Were you watching
trying to impress
me?
The girls. Still does.
just an amazing game. I love that series. And I think the last Ridge Racer game we got was on the Nintendo 3DS, which must be going back well over a decade ago now. And every year I look out for, you know, kind of what Bandai Namco are doing. I also think it would be amazing to see another Ridge Racer game coming out. And this has maybe got my hopes up ever so slightly, but maybe not. We'll talk a bit more about that in a second. But this is Bandai Namco, who are launching a new initiative. Apparently they're going to be licensing out IPs to a lot of their classic games. In fact, 27 of them.
Yeah, it's like weirdly, like, you're like, oh, is this exciting? But then you're like, oh, maybe it's not, I don't know. So I first saw this the other day, and I just read a little bit about it, and I thought, oh, maybe this is off the back of kind of like what Konami have been doing. So obviously Konami came out of the, you know, video game stratosphere, what, God, about 7 years ago? Ooh. And then recently came back with the Silent Hill 2 remake, which, you know, people have said is fantastic, and I'm currently playing through at the moment. I'm enjoying it, and there's Metal Gear Solid 3 remake coming out. But Konami have kind of like licensed these out to developers, and then they're just publishing it. So it's their own IPs, but they're getting other people to develop the games, and, you know, to great success at the moment. So I thought, oh, okay, maybe that's what Namco are doing. But then I saw the list and I was like, oh, hold on, like, Bandai Namco are still, like, they're not just in the game, like, they're full on in the game. Like, I was like, oh God, they own Dark Souls, they own Elden Ring was massive. There's a new Elden Ring coming out this year. Pac-Man, there's always Pac-Man games coming out. Tekken's still going and is still huge. Like, you know, I was like, oh God, like, they're still doing loads of games. So I found this quite odd. But then, like, as I read into it and I read about the IPs that they're kind of putting up, some of them are, like, you know, ones that are still going, but some of them, as you say, Dan, are Ridge Racer, which hasn't seen a new game in, I think it was 2016, so 9 years since the last one came out. And Soul Calibur, we've not had a Soul Calibur game for 8 years now.
Oh my God, that series, yes. Yes, yeah. More Soul Calibur.
The Doc Hack series, which were PS2 games.
By the way, you got me excited then. That Ridge Racer 2016 was just a mobile game. I miss one?
Nah, sorry. Little Nightmares, which I know a lot of people loved. Wonderswan, which isn't a game, but is the little handheld consoles that Bandai Namco did in the late 90s. That's on the list. I'm not going to read all 27.
That is random.
That is probably that random. Just to name a few others, Ace Combat is on there.
Katamari Damacy as well. And,
Katamari Damacy, I enjoy those games.
Mr. Driller and...
Klonoa.
I can never say it.
Klonoa, they did do a Klonoa collection a couple of years ago after not doing a game for decades for Klonoa. So it's an interesting lineup, obviously with Dark Souls and Elden Ring and Tekken on there as well. So I guess it's not so much because the articles are reading like, oh, we might see games from different developers but being published kind of like, you know, because they're licensing out the rights. But then I'm thinking it's more so for, this is a bad example, but you know, like Primark, the clothes shop, have a like license out, they have loads of Disney clothes and stuff. I think it's a little bit more like that. Like it's for small merch, independent companies to buy the licensing to go do some t-shirts, to go do some, you know, to go do some merchandise, to go do some toys, etc. based on these IPs.
Evercade though? You know,
Evercade, but yes, that's a really good point. I was going to say, but I don't think it excludes from people making games, but I can't see somebody going on this website because they're all listed on this Namco website where you can contact Namco, you know, to get like a
promise. It's in Japanese, the site as well. We should mention that, isn't it?
It is in Japanese.
A bit of translation maybe in there.
I can't imagine if some little indie developer jumped on there and was like, yo, how much for me to go make my own Tekken game? I don't think they would license that out, or an Elden Ring game. Maybe they would for Ridge Racer if the right developer came along. But I think with Elden Ring, it's more likely they will license out figurines of the bosses or something. That's my take on it. Don't take it as like gospel, but that's what I think it is.
Well, I mean, like I said, the page on Namco's website is in Japanese, so there might be a bit of lost in translation with a lot of the articles we've been seeing over the last kind of few days of like, oh, we're going to get a new Ridge Racer game. But apparently, if you do translate the statement on the website to English, it kind of roughly translates as, we're looking for companies that can use our IPs for businesses, including commercialization, advertising, and marketing campaigns.
Which out of all of them, I think the Wonderswan's the most interesting for that then. Because, you know, maybe someone could create the hardware, you know, put it out there as well. What's that company that were redoing the like Atari stuff recently? And we covered them and they created like a little handheld as well. You know, one of those companies that does the hardware. It'd be interesting to see
what My Arcade. With
it. Yeah, My Arcade. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, or like Joe said, it could just be Wonderswan t-shirts in Primark coming soon.
I'd love that.
Yeah. Which would be the most unexpected thing ever to see next time my missus drags me around that god awful shop. But yeah, so it's interesting to see because, I mean, you know, I would love a new Ridge Racer game. Non-mobile, you know, proper one on the Xbox or PlayStation will be incredible. But it just seems, random collection in there. I mean, I don't understand, like, Pac-Man and Elden Ring and Tekken to an extent, but, yeah, stuff like Wonderswan and forgotten franchises. Yeah, a bit weird that they just kind of picked those kind of 27 out of their huge back catalogue. So hopefully there will be more than just some NAF T-shirts or even game collections would be cool. I mean, it'd be nice to see, like, a Ridge Racer collection available for the Switch or something. So interesting to see. We'll keep an eye on that story. And if you want to read more about that and everything else we talked about, you don't have to Google around. I save you the job every week. Check the show notes section of your podcast app, or you can head to our website and click through at theretrohour.com. Now, by the way, we do have a video version.
Yes.
Of the interview.
We actually have faces. We're starting to do a video version of stuff now. And, you know, our patrons are able to access it first as well. And I love the reaction to the last one we did. People said it really added to the interview. So, you know, this is something that we kind of might want to do in the future. And I look up podcasts online and you type them in and then suddenly it's like video of everything. And we're kind of a bit behind the times, aren't we?
Well, I was reading that apparently there was a, something like in January, 1 billion people watched podcasts on YouTube.
Yeah, yeah. So let's get rid of
the biggest one ever. So we're experimenting with videos. If you'd like to, give us a bit of feedback and kind of join, I guess we call it a public beta, wouldn't we?
Well, that's,
we
roll video out
and test it a bit. Yeah. If you join our patrons community, you can access it on there. Lots of other perks as well. All the details are at theretrohour.com, including an extra 50 minutes of news stories that's on the way just for our lovely patrons. Before that, though, let's take a sec to give a massive thank you to this week's sponsor, and it is our incredible friends with the sound. It's Shopify. Now, I love having Shopify as a sponsor, long-term sponsor of this podcast, even before we used Shopify. It was always a service that I'd recommend to people. Like a mate of mine who wrote some books a couple of years ago. I remember at the time he was trying to like do WordPress plugins and stuff and sell it himself. Over the years, we sold our own books on there. A friend of mine set up a t-shirt business. Used our little promo link to try Shopify out for free. He's been using it for a year now. My missus recently set up a Shopify store to sell some arts and crafts online. It really is designed for anything you want to sell, online or in person. Shopify is the all-in-one e-commerce platform designed to start, run, and grow your business. So maybe you've got a bit of a side hustle going on, or maybe you want to start your own business. Shopify is revolutionizing millions of businesses all around the world. Best thing about it as well is all of my friends can use it because it's so easy.
Yeah, it's super easy. So I saw a photo of Sam Dyer, who runs Bitmap Books, and he's just hit the milestone of 100,000 orders through Shopify.
That's impressive.
Which is very impressive indeed. And, you know, it's an absolutely great service. You can do physical products, but you can also do digital ones as well. And digital ones are great because you can even watermark your products and you can have it delivered instantly as well. So even when you're not there, it just gets delivered straight away. It's got great 24-hour support as well, which is really important because you don't want any downtime at all.
Yeah, I think that digital service as well, we did that with our ebooks, didn't we?
Yeah.
I mean, before I was trying to do by emailing a copy to everyone. You know, Shopify does it all for you. Even sending them out physically, prints out the shipping labels, takes care of all the postage costs, does it all for you as well. So that means you can concentrate on running your business and the things that you enjoy doing. Shopify will take care of the rest of it for you. So even if you're doing in-person sales as well, they've got those shop-ready point-of-sale systems if you're at trade shows and that kind of thing, and it syncs your catalogue across both as well. Full of industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth every step of the way. No new skills to learn in coding or design. It does it all for you. So if you want to try it for yourself, it is time to get serious about selling and give Shopify a try. And if you want to give it a go, we've got a £1 a month trial period that you can get right now. Use our link. They'll know that we sent you. Helps out the podcast. Head to shopify.co.uk/retrohour, all lowercase. I'll put it in the show notes. shopify.co.uk/retrohour, and take your business to the next level today with our friends at Shopify, and get ready to hear a lot more of this. All right, well, thank you for checking out the news this week. We'll have more for you on next Friday's podcast. A little reminder as well, if you spot any news stories during the week and you think, oh, that'd be good for the guys to cover on the podcast, we have a Discord server that you can join through our website. The invite's up there. A little channel in there dedicated to news stories, so we always appreciate any help, any extra eyeballs on stories throughout the week, and always nice to chat to you in Discord as well. So if you'd like to join that, all the details are at theretrohour.com. Right, then next, going inside the world of good old game, GOG, G-O-G, and they're talking about their new preservation program next on the Retro Hour podcast.
So you're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and we are here with GOG. It's amazing to have good old games on, and you know, they're talking about their preservation project at the moment and program, which seems really interesting because they're kind of preserving the games, but they're also doing them up. And there's a lot of really good titles as well of, you know, games that we absolutely enjoy. So we've got Martin and Adam here. How are you doing, guys?
We're doing great. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, great to have you here.
Oh, it's great to have you on. And I saw an article in Vice as well, which was very interesting, talking about your program. But first, let's talk about like how you guys got involved with GOG then.
Yeah, maybe I'll go first because I have a shorter history than Patrick. I'm Adam, but at GOG, everyone calls me Adim because when I joined, there were like four or three Adams already at the company. So we need to differentiate. And that's kind of stick. So I've been working with GOG for 5 years now. I started as the game releases trooper, then moved to technical production. And now I'm working with our reverse engineers in bringing back the old games to GOG.
So you're doing the kind of technical side of, you know, getting these games working and dealing with all the difficulties.
the biggest part is done by my colleagues, but I also do some groundwork here. So, yeah.
What about you, Marcin?
I'm a bit of a GOG fossil because I've been with the company since the very beginning in 2008. So I started as a tester. Then I was handling the releases on GOG. Then I was leading the department that was handling, you know, game fixing, testing, releasing, and a bit of a backend for the developers. And then a couple of years ago, I like switched my career, so to speak, and moved to BizDev. And I am here ever since.
One of our questions that we always ask our guests, and I'll start with you, Adam, is, what systems did you grow up with? What were your earliest kind of gaming memories, whether they were console or PC?
Oh, that's a very good question. I was hoping to finally have time to, you know, talk about it. But yeah, my first system was Atari 65. That was the first one. The ones that, you know, you guys obviously know that you put the cassette in and then wait 15 minutes before anything loads. my favorite game there is actually a Polish one, and it kind of kicked my interest into video games. There was this Polish title called Robo, and then they created another version of it called Robo Constructor. So Robo was a bit like Sokoban, but with more interactive objects. And what Robo Constructor did, it allowed you to create your own levels and share them through also cassettes, then that was pretty cool. And
was there a Polish Atari scene then, and you know, people kind of doing like homebrew developments and like local
Atari was pretty big here. Atari and Commodore C64.
To this day, I think we had one of the largest scenes for, you know, Atari stuff.
That's interesting. And what about you, Marcin? Was it similar, was it Atari or completely different?
My like first that I played was one of those super old Atari consoles, the one that had Pong in it.
Oh.
But you also need to take into consideration that those arrived in Poland relatively late. So we are talking like a very,
you're a bit younger 80s. Than them.
Exactly. So we are talking about like a late 80s. I had a Commodore C64. I didn't have like the out of the tour. I was the Commodore guy. After that, I had the so-called in Poland Pegasus, which is basically like a pirated version of Super Nintendo.
Oh, cool. Wow. Okay.
That's actually Famicom. That's not Super.
Oh.
This was the older one.
That was Famicom, not Super Famicom. Yes,
exactly. Apologies. Did it play the actual Nintendo cartridges or was the whole...
Yeah. It did, but the interesting part here is because it was cloned from the Japanese version. So it used the smaller cartridges than what you guys have in the States.
Oh, so it's a little half ones.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, that's it was really produced like locally here. It was relatively cheap. So yeah, you need to remember that those were the days like the 89th and early 90s where it was right after the transition from the, you know, us being on the other side of the Iron Curtain.
Yeah.
So it was a bit weird here. So the only way to actually play some games and to get anything was to actually to pirate them because nothing was officially released in our region. So that's how it all started. Then it was PC and
With the, because that's quite interesting because obviously it's not something me and Ravi would be familiar with, but with the pirating and stuff like that, did that go on quite a while then in Poland after, you know, the war came down and all that kind of stuff? Like, was there then like a Super Nintendo clone system, an N64 clone system, or did by the mid-90s, did you start getting the official stuff?
Yeah, more or less in like mid-90s, 96, something like that, because the PlayStation was officially released in Poland. Super Nintendo 64. It was super expensive.
Yeah.
It was basically at the cost of like an average salary in Poland or something ridiculous like that. And the games were super expensive as well. So although those consoles were released in Poland, like like 90% of them were modified to be able to actually play pirated games. Because you are spending your entire salary on a console, and then you need to spend another like third of your salary on a game. So that didn't really work.
After communism, you didn't have the distribution network set up correctly.
No.
And then they kind of came in and, you know, Good Old Games is a really good distribution network actually for retro games. And I found, you know, previously there'd be a lot of stuff like piracy and ROMs and stuff like this, but actually having a service that looks after the games, preserves them and gets them running has been incredibly important for gamers. When you joined, Marcin, what was it like? And did you think, you know, this idea was really going to have legs and kind of grow?
When I joined, so it was like back in 2008, the idea grew from the fact that that was that weird time. If you remember when, you know, there was a new Windows version practically every like 3 years. Yeah. There was, you know, this full transition and the, you know, the removal of Microsoft MS-DOS from the Windows. It was no longer supported. So, you know, we had, after Windows XP, there was Windows Vista. Before that, it was, I think, Windows Millennium. So it was all over the place.
Yeah.
On top of that, we need to also remember that was the time, like, before, like the digital side of things really could kick off. Like it was a really like getting its bearings there, but there were still like a lot of games that were just, you know, just a few years ago released only physically.
People were quite cautious of stuff like Steam as well, and that took a while. You know, Half-Life really helped it get momentum. But you're right as well, with all those different versions of Windows, it must have been a nightmare. With compatibility, just even running DOS games on some of them. Adam, what were your experiences of some of those kind of changes within Windows and how they affected games?
I really remember the moment when Windows XP was released, and it basically broke all the games, almost every game that was clicked for DOS. So yeah, it was quite a
remember there were like painful experience. Some workarounds where you had to turn off security and you had to turn off user account control and stuff, and
or even go all the way and just, you know, install DOS and make the, you know, the make you able to switch systems before
registry editing and stuff that.
Or registry editing, that's my favorite stuff right now.
So, yeah, it was really all over the place then. So that's where, you know, we saw a problem that needs to be solved. And by we, I mean mainly Marcin Iwiński, so one of the founders of CD Projekt Red. And that's how the idea for GOG originated, right?
Awesome. So for our listeners who aren't aware what the game preservation program is at GOG, can one of you kind of give us a summary of what that is and where you're at with it?
Yeah, we were always releasing classic games. So since the very beginning of the platform, retro games Inc. and classic games was our focus, and we have a lot of them currently on GOG. So we are talking around 2,000 titles that we consider classic, probably even more than that currently. And what was happening is that, you know, we were very good at releasing them and making sure that they work at the moment on the release. But unfortunately, regrettably even, we could have been better at maintaining them. But the problem was that, you know, we were releasing more and more, and there were more and more of them. And so there is not a single publisher in the world that is maintaining that many games at once. And we are still not a huge platform, right? So with passing time, we noticed that there is actually a noticeable decline, even in games that were released, that used DirectX 9. But we couldn't like just take everything and retest it and fix everything. You know, we are talking 2,500 titles. And I need to clarify one thing. We do not have like games broken that are broken on GOG. If a user says us that, hey, this game like stopped working, that was always a priority one for us to fix. So every game on GOG, every classic game works. With the program, we wanted to basically make sure that they not only work, but also provide user with the proper experience on the, you know, on the high enough level. What I mean by that is basically you are launching a game, so you need to expect it to behave like any other game that you are buying now. So the alt-tab needs to work. If you change the resolution, the game cannot crash. Right, you cannot have random crash during the game. Yeah, you cannot have stuttering in the game, and things like it needs to support, you know, widescreen monitors. It needs to support two monitors at the same time. So that's actually what the program is. So not only making sure that they work, but also making sure that they work flawlessly on all of the modern PC configurations, and even more. There is our commitment that we will continue to maintain them in the future as long as GOG exists. So that level of quality that we set with the program will be maintained for all of the games in the program. And all of the games in the program have the label, right? And that this is a way for us to basically to say, to let the users know which games on GOG already went through that process, and that process will be quite long because, like I said, we are talking about 2,500 right now titles at GOG that have a potential to be in the program, meaning that they are maintained already by us. And the goal is to have around 500 by the end of the year, and then with each year we want to have more games, and hopefully with the growing popularity of the program and with more people that will be involved in maintaining those games and in making sure that everything is right, we will be able to reach our goal of having all of those our games in the program in a few years.
I think that's interesting that you've got that kind of quality seal on there as well, because it does define them. And previously, you're right, there was so many games on GOG, and people have so many different setups as well. Having it running in those resolutions and running with certain graphics cards and stuff. I remember at one point there were like launch options for Steam as well, where you had to like launch certain stuff and put codes within there to get it in the right widescreen mode and stuff like that. So it's really good that focus is happening. I was wondering what the technical difficulties have been, Adam, then, because I guess you have to take all of these titles and start working with all this different hardware. What's the testing process and kind of the troubleshooting process with a title?
I mean, for each title that is considered to get a badge, we do an initial QA testing in our test lab. We have different machines that we run the game with. Different setups, so it's either NVIDIA or RTI, because those, like you said, behave differently. And then the guys from QA send us a report. This worked, that didn't. We also really rely on what community says. So we are also checking our forums and also external sites, because like you said, most of those problems may be actually already solved, but it needs a lot of steps
for users to do that with all the machines in the world. So having your kind of community is really good to kind of give your feedback, you know.
Yeah, but our biggest tool for that, I would say, is the DirectX wrapper that we are developing. So right now, we are able to almost fully support all the DirectX versions up to 7. So this makes the game display and run properly on modern DirectX versions. We are in deep development of DirectX 9. We have some games that are already supported by it, but it's like, you know, it's not something that we can just roll on everything. But yeah, that's our main thing that to do. And then, like you said, like we did say earlier, there's a lot of stuff first to understand on what the game actually does when it's installed. So like registries, what registries does it make and how does it use it? And what happens when you change something? What does it store in the ini files or save files? And sometimes even where those save files are. This all, you know, makes for a lot of work. And then there's also a tool that we sometimes rely on or usually rely on, but it started to be a bit depreciated because actually the Windows compatibility tool is a powerhouse, but it has a lot of functions that are hidden to normal users. But there is a tool that allows you to unlock some of the configuration that allows for additional stuff to be done with the game and not crash, like Marcin said, for example, to be able to add
it. It sounds like a lot of work obviously goes into it, a lot of hard work. So I was wondering, what's the most difficult game, you know, GOG have ever worked on in terms of restoration and preservation, and why? What's the story?
I think Dino Crisis is the biggest story, yeah.
Wow.
Not only the recent one, but also it was a ride.
It was... having Resident Evil games was always like when I joined the business department at GOG, that was always something that I wanted to achieve at some point. Although I cannot take a credit for that because at the end I wasn't the person who actually signed those games with Capcom, but I did help a bit. So it was a process that basically took years. To convince Capcom that, you know, those couple of Polish dudes are really trustworthy to actually handle one of their most important titles, which is Resident Evil and Dino Crisis. So after we managed to convince them that we are actually the guys who can do the job in on the level and in the quality they expect, then there was a huge process that Adam led that was preparing the games.
Like Marcin said, we pulled all of our guns there and did all we could to make our version the best possible version. While also for our list, the important stuff is because, you know, you have mods and stuff like that and you have stuff that changes the game. We wanted to make it running on modern systems, look sharp, and also be as true to the original as possible, including the tank controls and all that jazz. So, so for everyone to experience this game the same way as when it was released 20 years ago, I guess. But yeah, from the stuff that we did, one of the biggest ones that I think is really important is the geometry correction that we did. So, because this was a direct port from PSX from PlayStation 1 to PC. And this port actually also included all the warping texture that PlayStation does. This is like the modern, not modern, but this is like the staple of PlayStation. So we were able to rewrite the engine a bit. So now the textures are staying in place and everything is like, you know, looks like you would expect it to look nowadays. Other cool stuff that we added there was our controller support. So even though the controllers are like they were in the old days, now we actually can support all the modern controls as well. So you can expect that if you actually now, if you put and plug anything, it should work. And yeah, once we had the build ready, it was not yet done. We then had to go through a very thorough QA sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Those are internal sessions, and then we are also having a joint session with the Capcom team. Because yeah, they have their own standards and everything, and we had to match those standards. And in the end, we could. But yeah, I think it took almost 3 months, this QA session.
Oh, yeah. Oh wow.
Yeah. So that was a while. And in the meantime, we were fixing the builds and adding stuff and everything. Mm. And we are still maintaining the builds. We are still adding stuff there based on what our users say that they would like to have or that doesn't really work for them. So yeah.
Yeah, and on top of that, the game has a couple of language versions.
Mm.
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, because it's actually, when you like look at it, usually nowadays you can just switch the language on the fly for the games and you're good to go. But here you actually had six versions, like six separate games.
Yeah.
So all of those had to go through separate QA sessions, and all of them had some quirks that had to be taken care of. If I remember, that was not a Spanish version. Yeah, that was a Spanish version that had like missing subtitles at some points, because the game is all voiced in English, but the only localization stuff is translations. But we discovered that at some point the stuff would just be cut out. So we re-implemented some of the text with, of course, Capcom's permission, just to make it the same, the way it was supposed to be.
Yeah, so we basically fixed a bug in the game that was there from the very beginning. So after 25 years, fixed.
Yeah, Resident Evil is my favorite franchise of all time for gaming. Resident Evil 2, favorite game of all time. And it's really good to see that. I spend most nights, I always end up on YouTube watching videos about Resident Evil, and recently watching, you mentioned the mods there and the modding community and everything of Resident Evil. Mm-hmm. And it's really nice to see when you watch all the different comparison videos that GOG, their version always comes out, you know, your version always comes out on top now, you know, this is the best way to play this, you know, these days kind of thing. So it's really, really good to see. And for those titles, those original titles to be recognized and, you know, accessible for a modern audience now.
Yeah. And this is actually something, because you mentioned the modding community, this is also something that we try to do our best because each game that is released on GOG, if it happens a modding community, one of the main things that we are checking is that our version is compatible with what is already out there.
Yeah.
So that was true for those games as well. Not always we can assure that 100%, and in some cases we cannot just, you know, go to the community and say we'll be releasing this in a few weeks, and you know, if here is the new exe file, can you just switch a couple of things in your mod to make it compatible. Unfortunately we cannot do it. We cannot do it because what we fully acknowledge and realize that many games that we are releasing has an absolutely amazing modding communities, especially Resident Evil games. So it's the mods there are really, really cool in our opinion. They're adding a very interesting things to the to the game. They are changing it in a lot of interesting ways. So we want to make sure that if our users would like to, you know, try that. That experience, they would be able to do so. We cannot do the same changes sometimes in our games because, as Adam said, one of the main focus is preserving the original experience. Mm. So we need to be very careful with what we are changing. Even, you know, those geometry fixes, the floating textures was something that we were discussing if we should actually change that part or not. But the community, our users seems to be very happy with that version, so it stays.
I think like the selection of games is fantastic as well, because you've got the big titles in there, you've got the big ones, and there seems to be more of those coming as well, which is really interesting. But you've also got, like, looking at it, it's like my PC from my childhood. You know, you've got Jazz Jack Rabbit in there. You've got Leisure Suit Larry, you know, SimCity 3000 as well. All of these kind of SWAT 4, which is just a great game as well.
Amazing.
How do you make this selection, Marcin? And like, what's the process of deciding on which games you're going to induct into the preservation program?
Yeah, when we first started thinking about this, we basically, you know, used the easiest, so to speak, but I think also most relevant metric, which is basically how many people own that game on GOG. Because we wanted to basically, with the launch, we wanted to impact the biggest amount of users. And not surprisingly, a lot of those games also, you know, are widely considered the best in the genre or in the era that they've been released in. So that was one of the things. However, there was also another in which we wanted to either have complete series, or we wanted to have a proper representation from each genre. And of course, we needed to take into consideration the amount of work it is required to actually fix those games. So there are many games that are still waiting from the top list on GOG, because we wanted to basically have those 100 games at launch. So we wanted to needed to adjust our pipelines to make that go, to make that happen. However, that priority list is still there, and we hope to have all of the biggest, so to speak, classic games from GOG in the program relatively soon.
That's interesting, because some of those titles I wouldn't assume would have the huge numbers. And I bet looking behind the scenes, it's like, wow, there's a lot of people playing this one, or, you know, a lot of people are nostalgic for a title that may not have necessarily been the biggest hit at the time, or been a bit of a cult one and kind of grown some momentum.
Yeah, there are a couple of games like that that have a surprisingly huge amount, following, that at the time of releasing them was a bit of a surprise even for us. But like I said, another thing was actually to, you know, for us to be able to get the number that sounds good at launch. So we are also, like, to be perfectly honest, we're looking for games that are cool and do not have that many issues found that we need to fix. So that's the reason for the selection that is currently there.
So I was wondering, do you work like closely with the emulators then as well? Because you know, some fire up in DOSBox as well, and some, like you said, ScumVM. Do you ever contact those teams and say to them, "Hey, could you get this working?" Or you know, have communication with them?
Yeah, back in the days, we were closely working with. I don't want to butcher this name, but with the creator of DOSBox, and the Cubics, right? And one of the things that I think we figured out together is how to actually get cloud saves working on GOG for DOSBox games. And it's actually not something other platforms have, let's say that. We have a way of making every game that is in preservation program now, that is DOSBox emulated, has cloud saving support.
Yeah, so we have like our own version, our own branch of DOSBox. Yeah. And obviously DOSBox is open source, so our branch and the source code for it is available there. We try to, we are working as closely as possible with the authors of those emulators. Those are, of course, community projects, but there are usually people who are at the time doing the most work, and they are helping us a lot in making sure that the release that we are having on GOG has the, you know, the proper, so to speak, setup. But nowadays, I think we are more or less doing it autonomous, like on the GOG side. We have our own, you know, templates. We have a very detailed, so to speak, know-how or how to adjust those bugs in order to make sure that the game is working in the correct way. Right now we are more or less able to handle it ourselves with basically tweaking the emulator settings.
Yeah, but just configuration, and sometimes it's like getting back to the old days and writing the autoexec config again, so the so the game knows what it needs to do before that. So it knows what it needs to do before it actually gets launched.
But it's
so
good to have someone do it for you rather than have to scrape through forms.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's why you get when the game is preserved in the preservation program, just press play and you don't need
to. And it's not only just getting them going as well. You guys are adding a lot of extras to the games as well. So there's some bonus content and there's some stuff coming from fans as well and collectors as well. What are your experience of working with fans, Marcin?
With fans, like, amazing. Like, my best experience with working with fans is definitely Wing Commander. I work with I'm not sure if I should say his name,
Mr. Anonymous.
Mr. Anonymous. He is currently working on Star Citizen team, so I'm not sure if this is something. So he was a member of the Wing Commander community. Basically, when we were releasing those games, we noticed that, hey, this is a huge community. They have a lot of good, cool stuff there, right? So, yeah, we reached out to them, and they were extremely helpful. When they found out that we are bringing back Wing Commander games, it was basically all hands on deck.
Yeah.
So, basically, it might sound bad because in that particular case we didn't need to do much at GOG, but nevertheless it was an amazing experience. We worked with them and they were basically, okay, just do this, release this, and okay, give me 2 days and I will create the best version of Wing Commander, right? So basically he created a version in which, because there's a problem there, that there was a never of a version that had the best graphics and the best movies. So we kind of have something new at GOG that have high-res movies and everything else is also perfect. And we, you know, we tested it on GOG, we added a couple of tweaks, and we basically had a free release. We also get a lot of amazing bonus content from them. So if you go to Wing Commander page at GOG, you have, you know, like a Wing Commander Bible, like a manual, some design docs, some arts, sketches, and so on and so forth. There's a lot of that stuff there, and it's, you know, it's on GOG, so it's, you know, preserved for ages.
It's like a little kind of tribute to the game, you know, having that for a really dedicated fan kind of makes it worth purchasing.
Yeah. And our community is helping us as well, because they are there just waiting to tell us if we missed something. So whenever we are releasing a game and, for example, we are missing a, you know, Spanish manual or something like that, you know, someone is, okay, here it is, just add it. There was a time in which we got like a huge box of manuals that we didn't have, different language versions from one of our fans who is like a big collector of games. And he basically sent it over to us to this whole thing to scan. So the person who was doing that did not have a great time. I'm joking, of course. We basically switched, but it took a while, and we were scanning all of them and just, you know, digitalizing them in that way and immortalizing them. And after that, we just send it all back. Our fans are extremely helpful with our mission, which is game preservation, and making sure that basically everything that was released for that game officially is included in our version and digitalized.
Fantastic. I was wondering if we could talk about kind of like any sort of licensing issues you might have had with games over the years. So obviously you've got the Fallout series on your game preservation. You've got Fallout 1 and 2 and then New Vegas, but ownership of those games obviously has changed, developers have changed and stuff over the decades with that. Have you ever kind of had any issues with getting those kind of games licensed, or is it a little bit more straightforward than that? What's the kind of like, what's the journey there?
Yeah, if currently a game is higher on our dream list and we do not have it on GOG, it's mostly because of the licensing issues. Mm. Okay. So that is like the main problems, one of the main problems that I'm solving by working in the biz dev at GOG. So because in order to be able to release the game, one party needs to have, okay, it can be more than one, but basically you need to have a collection of all of the rights in one place, more or less. So this is, you know, the distribution, worldwide distribution rights, rights to every language version, rights to the IP, rights to the code, and so on, so forth. So in the best scenario, everything is within the one company. Thankfully, with Fallout, it was relatively easy because Bethesda bought all of the rights from Interplay. So we basically switched the publisher on GOG, and that was it. Unfortunately, that is not always the case, that this transition goes so smoothly. And so you have, for example, a game like, I don't know, like Black and White, which is basically a weird situation. Also, I'm not sure that I am able to, that I should say who has what.
Yeah.
But it's basically, you know, Microsoft is involved.
It was Lionhead Studios, wasn't it? And then it went
it
off.
Was,
to, yeah, yeah.
It was Lionhead Studios. So basically you have two big companies and one has the rights to the IP and the other has the rights to the actual games. So, you know, you need to basically bring them together and be able to work up some kind of business deal in order to make it worth their while. So, and because there are two big guys, so the every revenue will be like split in half. Or they need to basically figure out who is taking the whole thing. But you know, without like tens of millions of dollars in the deal, those big companies probably are not usually eager to have their even financial or legal department involved in the complicated things like that. So this is one of the problems that I am trying to solve by just, you know, trying to figure out what is the business angle for this for them. Is there a solution that we can find that will be easy to implement and so on and so forth? It requires a lot of patience, but it's after a while of knocking at the same door with different ideas, eventually the door open and we have a great release, another amazing release on GOG. So there are a lot of games that we cannot release because they had some licensing, some license thing in them with an expiration date. So in order to release them, you need to renew all of the licenses. Sometimes it might be difficult because, for example, the license was, I don't know, licensed by someone who made the music for the game and that person is dead. And how do you go from here? Okay, there are ways, but it can get pretty complicated. With Alpha Protocol, we basically work closely with Sega to basically have the rights renewed. There are a couple of other games with a similar problem that we have on GOG, in which we needed to basically renew the license or work with the publisher to renew the licenses for. But unfortunately for the games, like, I don't know, like Need for Speed or all of the FIFA games, like those licenses are basically gone. You would need to have like a truckload of money to even tackle that idea of releasing those games. I would love to do that at some point. FIFA 97... My
that was your jam. Yeah.
But unfortunately, like, not probably going to happen anytime soon. But maybe one day.
I was also wondering, Adam, you talked about reverse engineering earlier on, and imagine, you know, there's a few games out there with the source code missing, not that much information on it, and you're kind of chucked in there with this challenge of, you know, making it run beautifully. What's the process there and the kind of difficulties?
I mean, most usual cases where the source code is gone or is not available. So even usually when you get the source code, it's actually a pretty smooth ride because we can do basically almost everything with it. But if there's none, then you need to like start with small things and reverse engineer. And because basically you use a program that shows you what different functions does do, but those functions have no names. So you need to figure out what is the name of the function so to know what it does. So you start with something small, like for example, the easiest one is, I think it's the my favorite one again, registry entries, because they are usually the same place. So you can start from there and start naming some of them and go from there and go from there.
So like you're kind of prodding and poking. Like, people used to have the action replay carts on machines and they would try to find the different codes and cheats. That's kind of what you're doing then.
Yeah, you change something, you run the game and see if it even runs. If not, then you have something there. But also sometimes just disabling the function totally also gives us some new ideas.
Have you ever found anything where you're just like, what were they doing? Like, why did they decide to do that? You know?
Different developers have different approach and there are many schools of how to make the game or maybe even not school. So sometimes, usually the people just go, rogue. There are some stuff that...
What as well about DRM, because digital rights management, you've got a few titles that used to have DRM as well. Do you have to kind of strip that out and clean it up? And essentially that is a bit like piracy in a way because you're kind of removing the protection, but you're actually selling the product. So it must be a strange process, so kind of a bit of an alien one to you.
Well, we don't rely on cracks, I can tell it now, but
you don't crack the games.
that's why we don't have all the solutions, because there are some DRMs that we still aren't able to solve for various reasons. We have our workaround on most of them now, that we can. Now it's easy, like it's usually easy with the way we have, laid the workaround.
I was wondering, Marcin, as well, like where do you want to take this program then? How big do you want it to be? Because preservation is a thing that, lasts for a long time and hopefully is around forever, for not just us to play, younger generations to play this kind of games.
Yeah, it's, the preservation is a process. It's not something that you do once and it's there. So it's not like, packaging something and putting it on a shelf in the museum. In terms of like a digital goods, there needs to be a constant work, right? So because there are new operating systems, new drivers, the technology is moving forward. So the maintenance of those games, the more there are, the more work it will require for us. But we are fairly confident that we'll be able to keep up, so to speak. This is actually one of the reasons we haven't launched that program, 2 years ago. And the reason is that we didn't feel that we have the tools and the knowledge and expertise needed to actually maintain those games in a scale of 1,000+. Which is basically more than any publisher in the world right now, I think. So it was a huge commitment. So we will continue to add more and more games. One of the things that we use if a game is ready for a program is if it's a classic, and classic for us means that the game is 10 years old. Mm-hmm. So as you imagine, with the passing of time, more and more games become classic titles. So this will never end.
Mm-hmm.
There will be more and more games, and hopefully we will be getting better at maintaining them in a scale, and hopefully we'll be able to tackle any challenges the future might throw at us. We had like a brainstorm of what can possibly go wrong, and we are fairly confident that we can handle even the most weird scenarios.
Yeah.
So it will just continue to grow, and more games will be there. Hopefully, in a couple of years, we'll be talking about thousands.
I think it's going to be a great resource for, like, you know, even education. So, like, if kids were looking at some of the titles and how the titles developed, you know, they could go back and play some of the original versions of it.
Yeah, but it's really good. It's not even kids, but well, the developers of new games as well. Like, the number of times I was asked for a code or two for a classic game on GOG from a developer who is working on a next AAA game.
Yeah.
You can guess who that might have been.
I love that.
So, because a lot of those games have very cool features that are, you know, all only there, and they are kind of forgotten. So people are, you know, like to go back and to check them out and see what was in there to maybe be able to use that knowledge and that feature and, like, you know, re-implement it in a new title. So yeah, there is a lot of that. And, you know, and those classic games are not for, like, for the 40 plus generation. Like, the funny thing that we actually notice at GOG is that a lot of the times the classic games are right now bought by people that haven't even been born when those games were released.
That's amazing to hear, you know.
That is absolutely amazing, because the retro gaming is kind of, I think, is getting a bit popular right now, and there are certain games that really aged amazingly. So, for example, our prime example is always Heroes of Might and Magic 3. That game is freaking perfect.
Yeah.
So there are more games like that. And on top of that there are modding communities that, you know, take a game that is 30 years old and create something that is absolutely amazing. I feel like, look, for example, at the mods that we currently have for Doom 2, right? Absolutely amazing stuff. And there is more of that, like another game, Total Annihilation. Like, even two weeks ago, I played a mod for this game that basically, like, adds, like, 1,000 units, three times as big of a map.
Which was notorious for crashing in the first place. So even adding more units is like, you know.
Yeah, and for some miracle, I have no idea what they did, it works.
Wow.
So we had a game over, a multiplayer game with my friend over LAN. VPN, I still miss those days when we were actually, like, bringing PCs together and connecting them from null modem connection or whatever. It's really amazing what is out there. And this actually is something that we want to do at GOG this year, to bring that amazing scene closer to the mainstream audience, by simply releasing those mods on GOG in a way that would allow you to just click a button and just play the game without going through the hassle of 30 steps how to install that mod. This is actually something that we want to do this year. So kind of following up on what we did with Fallout London. Yeah, so that will be hopefully a lot of those more great mods out there will be released, able to release on GOG in a form in which you can basically just go to the platform, add the mods to your account, click install, play, and that's it.
Wow.
Yeah. While also retaining the original game, because mods do something to the base game that makes it unplayable. We want to make it separate instance that you can, if you want, you can keep both. Not corrupting your saves and anything.
Yeah, there are so many amazing mods. Like, I can go hours about that. But like even when we started that project, I did the research about, you know, I know that there's a lot, but I in my wildest dreams, I didn't expect that there is that much of that many of absolutely amazing mods with an astonishing even amount of content.
For the
games that are, you know, 30 years old.
So we absolutely love what you guys have been doing. We've spoke about you on the news section of the show over the last couple of months since you announced the preservation in November and stuff like that. So our final question, and obviously if you can't tell us, if you can't answer it, you know, you're not allowed to, etc. Completely understand. But as well as the fantastic stuff you've just mentioned, are you able to tell us what games are next on the list for the preservation, Or if you can't tell us, what's a dream game, if you can tell us that instead?
I can only tell you that the next big game in the preservation program that we hope you will release in a couple of months will be a JRPG.
Okay.
Oh, nice.
Cool.
Nice.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what my dream game is. One day, Lord of the Rings, Battle for Middle-earth. That would be.
Oh, yeah.
Because yeah, that is really hard to run. I can imagine the writers for that all over the shop as well.
Yeah, but never say never.
Well, you know, it's been fantastic to have you guys on. We could like chat for hours, but I've just absolutely loved this. And I think it's really interesting and it's really important what you guys are doing. So all our listeners should definitely check out the Preservation Project, because there's some big titles on there. There's also some absolute bargains as well. If you look on there, the price range is totally varied, which is really good.
Yeah, thank you very, very much, guys, and thank you for your support.